Welcome to Guerrillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast, teaching Davids how to defeat Goliaths. Now here's your host, Mark Anthony Peterson.
Welcome back to the podcast for entrepreneurs, startups, and business mavericks. If you're not a business maverick, you don't have to go home, but you got to get up out of this podcast. In this podcast, we teach entrepreneurs how to defeat the corporate giant. Just like in the story of David and Goliath, David defeated a much taller and stronger Goliath, not by fighting the giant in hand-to-hand combat, but by using technology. A slingshot. The slingshot allowed the smaller David to attack from a distance that minimized the advantages that Goliath had over the smaller David. My name is Mark Anthony Peterson. I am a serial entrepreneur, a futurist, and the managing executive at Serial Consulting, a leading small business strategy and technology consulting firm. I am also the author of the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, which is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. This podcast is brought to you by Serial Consulting. An idea can launch a business. A strategy can take it global. Today's episode is a mastermind interview episode, and we're talking with Philip Williams. He is an entrepreneur extraordinaire and knows how to defeat the Goliaths. We're going to have a great conversation, and get your pens and papers out because you're starting your MBA today with Philip Williams as the instructor and the dean of this new business school. In our conversation, we're going to focus on, are you solving the right business problem? Let's get right into it, that interview with Philip Williams of AskPhilipWilliams.com. Guys, welcome to the show today. We have an entrepreneur extraordinaire. He is the three-time Inc. 5000 honoree after becoming the CEO of a 17-year-old cash-strapped company and growing it at 50% per year for 5 years. That resulted in two nearly simultaneous acquisition offers from two publicly traded multinational companies. He has accomplished this all by bootstrapping the business, no outside money. Mr. Philip Williams has had this entrepreneurial executive drive since he was 8 years old. And he joins us today on the podcast to ask CEOs and startup executives, are you solving the right problem? Mr. Williams, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Before we jump in, tell us a little bit about yourself. You've had this passion for solving business problems since you were 8 years old.
It's very interesting. I'm the child of a serial entrepreneur, if you will, and my dad owned several businesses when I was growing up. My mom owned one, and so I started learning about small businesses at the family dinner table. You know, I vividly remember my parents having conversations about whether or not they should raise prices or maybe how a customer service event wasn't handled well during the day and things of that nature. So it was just part of the fabric of my life, if you will, as I was growing up. And I just became so interested in how things operate in a small business. But my dad didn't want – he owned barbershops and he owned actually an auto salvage yard. He didn't want his sons to actually be – barbers, because I don't know if you know this or not, but cutting hair 8-10 hours a day is a physically very difficult thing to do. And so he encouraged both of his sons to go out and get education as much as we could. And so I did that. I went all the way through an MBA and got a mechanical engineering degree, all kinds of stuff like that. But I just kind of found myself coming back to it, if you will.
I've spent a little bit of time around barbershops. And the barbershop business is a terrific business, especially from a guerrillapreneur perspective. If you have an extra seat or seats that you can lease to other barbers to cover the overhead expenses, man, you throw a lot of cash to the bottom line. This low overhead, high cash business model must have seeped into your blood. And having both parents as entrepreneurs, that must have been special too. Is that what motivated you to do what you do? Because most small businesses fail before their 10th year in business.
You know, that's exactly right, Mark. You look at it, and I was very fortunate. You know, my dad's primary business ran for, I want to say it was, he owned it for over three decades before he finally sold it. And interestingly enough, he probably never spent more than $50 a month in advertising. All of his advertising was essentially word of mouth. And there were so many things that he did very, very well. And as I watched what he did, it became super apparent to me when he sold the business what some of the problems were. And, you know, you talk about how most businesses don't make it to their 10th year. In January of 2017, I believe it was, Harvard Business Review published an article, and in there was a statistic that 87% of businesses solved the wrong problem. Mm. And I started looking at that, and I thought, you know, that seems pretty interesting. So if you were to go to Google and say what, and just type in why do businesses fail, on the front page you're going to get 80 to 100 results. But if you go through there and you start looking, you know, everything from cash flow and can't get clients and my employees, you know, don't have work ethic and, you know, all kinds of different things, you can literally boil that down to a place where, you know, you're working on the wrong problem. And you almost feel like you're playing whack-a-mole.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's an HR problem, and then it's a cash flow problem. And so how do you figure out how to solve the right problem? And as I looked at it, it became apparent to me that a lot of companies don't solve the right problem. How do they fall into that? Well, many companies start because in the very beginning, the founder is fortunate enough to have a solution that works for several people at the beginning of the business. And they get a little bit of momentum and they get started, but they unfortunately fall in love with that solution. And over time, your clients evolve, the market evolves, and competition comes into the market, and they exert pressure on the market. And so things change. And that's how you fall into this situation where you're not solving the right problem.
Let me unpack this a little. As you solve the initial problem, the market evolves and a new problem emerges. And many companies, especially startups and small businesses, never evolve and face the new challenge. They keep solving the same old problem.
That is absolutely one of the truisms. You know, it's the Blockbuster versus Netflix.
Right.
You know, hate to beat that one. Don't want to beat that one too much, but, you know, that is really what it is. Blockbuster missed the mark on it. Netflix should have a competitor in the marketplace today, or they should be owned by Blockbuster because they had that opportunity. But they missed how the rest of us were looking to, you know, pick up our remote control from the couch and, you know, watch a movie. So if you're not paying attention to your client, and if you're not paying attention to how your employees do what they do, then you're going to find yourself in a spot before your business is 10 years old where you're solving the wrong problem. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, you talk about that statistic. You can look at different surveys year in and year out, and it's always somewhere between 80 and 90% of businesses don't make it to their 10th year. And so when I saw that statistic about 87% of businesses solving the wrong problem, it sort of hit me between the eyes.
I want to drill down on Blockbuster and Netflix. That's fascinating to me that Blockbuster was the giant. They were the Goliath and Netflix was the David. There was a Blockbuster in every major and minor city in America. At its peak, Blockbuster had about 9,000 stores. These guys thought they were evolving. They started with VHS tapes and evolved to higher quality offerings when they launched DVDs. I can remember going to their storefronts every Friday and getting 4 or 5 movies. I would never have guessed that those guys would disappear. walk us through where you think they went wrong. How could they be solving the problem one day and then let a startup completely disrupt their market?
It is a classic situation that happens over and over again. There, you can go back and find interviews of Sears executives where, you know, I believe it was, well, it was one of the major publications, and I don't know which one, but they were interviewing a Sears executive, and they say, "Hey, didn't you guys see Walmart coming?" And the answer is, "Yes, we saw them coming." "Well, why didn't you do something about it?" "Well, we didn't think those guys knew anything about how to run a massive retail operation. You know, they disrespected the competition." But the bigger problem is that they didn't pay attention to really what their clients were looking for. And if you don't pay attention to that, that is where the vast majority of the information is going to come from when it comes to how do you build your business. You need to be willing to look internally at what is going on with your business and what your clients want. And if you're paying attention to what they want, then you will be able to grow your business. But the trick of it is, it's actually two sides of the same coin. It's not necessarily what the client wants. It's what problem the client has that isn't being solved. I use the example where I bought a 1990 Toyota truck brand new. And I could have gotten the complete set of features that I bought in that Toyota, I could have purchased in a Chevrolet truck. But the Toyota had a cup holder.
Mm.
and that was something that was really, really important to me. I'm down here in Arizona. I need an ice cold drink everywhere I go pretty much 9 months out of the year.
Right.
And so, you know, what Blockbuster missed was telegraphed really by Steve Case and America Online way back in the late 90s when Steve Case decided to go out and buy Time Warner.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the driving factors for America Online buying Time Warner was they wanted access to the content library because they had intended to stream it through everybody's home. So Blockbuster should have seen what so many other people saw. Clearly, America Online saw it, Time Warner saw it, Netflix saw it. You know, streaming content through everybody's home was something that was a conversation that was going on almost everywhere. We were all looking for it. It was just a matter of who was going to deliver it and when they were going to deliver it. Because the problem is, you know, as you say, Mark, you know, you get home, it's a long week. How does Blockbuster miss it? I don't know. You know, on a Friday night, you know, your life pattern was, hey, I'm going to stop, I'm going to pick up a pizza, and I'm going to stop by Blockbuster and pick up two or three movies for the weekend, then I'm going to come home. Well, what Netflix was offering you was, hey, we're going to take one more stop out of your day, and we're going to give it to you at exactly the moment that you want it. And it was all about convenience. I'm not sure how Blockbuster misses that. And Blockbuster, you know, they missed two or three opportunities to buy Netflix. They were literally offered the opportunity to purchase that company and said no thank you.
Isn't that shocking?
It blows my mind. It blows my mind. But it goes back to not paying attention to, I call it white space, the problem that your client has that nobody is solving. Bob Lutz is another great one. You know, when he got to General Motors, he moved over from Chrysler. If you don't know who Bob Lutz is, he is the guy that created the Plymouth Prowler. He is the guy that ushered in the PT Cruiser design, great at developing products. And he got over to General Motors. And when he got there, he wanted to know who was responsible for launching the Pontiac Aztec because it was the ugliest thing that anybody had ever sold in a car company ever. And he talks about, he sent out a memo within days of arriving at General Motors. And it was very interesting because the Pontiac Aztec was launched based, and it was the first vehicle to ever hit 100% of the marks of the things that the clients in the focus group told General Motors they wanted. And so General Motors was listening to what do clients want, and they built what clients want. And what clients wanted turned out to be one of the ugliest, biggest automotive failures ever, and it became the Pontiac Aztec. And Lutz sent out a memo. He says, you cannot base what you're building on what clients tell you they want. You have to listen to their pain point. If you're listening to their pain points, you will be able to evolve your business in a way that allows it to grow.
That makes complete sense. And I hope the guerrillapreneurs understand this distinction. You know, at the end of each show, I say, if you're not breaking something, your company's going to be the next thing that gets broken. And that distinction between wants and pain points is a critical one, because a pain point can be monetized. Something that I want, if you're asking me and I am not tasked with paying for it, I'll give you a laundry list of those things. So I see exactly where you're going in terms of focusing the business enterprise around constantly solving a pain point that is critical to that industry. And in the Blockbuster case, it sounds like you're saying, and I totally agree with it, convenience is the area of competition that the customer is willing to reward with dollars. And it started with movie theaters, and Blockbuster providing a more convenient model for them to consume content, but it's not where the consumer wanted to end. And so the next convenience disruptive model was Netflix. And even Netflix has evolved from mailing you DVDs and CDs and other content to streaming it, as you said. So they've continued to push along that continuum, making it more convenient and growing their business model as a result. So, yeah, I that distinction to me, that's a critical nugget.
And one of the things that you have to realize is that no two clients will express their frustration or their pain point in the same way. You know, when I got to Hyder Geophysics, we were looking for a way to grow revenue. And we had a few clients that had the same problem, could be solved with the same tool, but they weren't speaking the same language. In fact, they were actually in different industries, but they had the same problem. And you almost have to be able to read the tea leaves, and you have to, you know, get some yellow stickies out and write down things that they say and stick them on a whiteboard and just accumulate those over a few months. And when you start to do that, it will paint a picture for you, and you can start looking. You say, okay, well, what solves this group of pains, and what solves that group of pains? And what I did was I started looking and I said, you know what these clients need is, you know, they need a data acquisition system that will collect a lot of data very quickly, but they need it at a low cost, because nobody wants to pay to have an environmental problem monitored. I mean, that's, you know, that's a multi-decade problem. So, you know, how do you get it down cheap? But they weren't saying that. In fact, the business that I was in, clients didn't even want to talk about it. They did not want to talk about environmental problems. If you look at your utility company's financials at the end of the year, there's no such thing as reserves for future unknown environmental problems. That would scare investors to death, right?
Right.
So they were very veiled in how they expressed their problem, and no two clients talked about it in the same way. So you have to be accumulating their sentences and their statements and looking at them and say, okay, what does this look like? What is this thing that they're describing? What would it look like? And the next step that we did was I went out into the market and I looked and I said, okay, well, who sells something that will do that? And it came back, and this absolutely blew my mind. Just the hardware alone was going to be almost $500,000.
Wow.
And I just could not believe that in that time, in today's world, that kind of technology would cost that kind of money. And on top of that, it would only give us one data set a day, and I wanted like a data set every 15 minutes. So I just refused to accept that the solution that was available was actually the penultimate thing that could be achieved at the time. And so that's part of it, too, is you have to refuse, you almost have to reject. You know, there's going to be an existing solution in the market once you identify your client's problem. The question is that actually going to get it done? And I can tell you right now, our clients would not have paid that kind of money for the equipment and then all of the monitoring and everything on top. So you have to get very in tune to how they talk about their problem and realize that they may not describe it very clearly. And then, as you say, Mark, you know, that pain point, people will pay for pain. They'll pay to get rid of pain. They will not pay to receive joy.
Right.
And so you have to ask them. You have to ask them, if I could solve that, and this is the really this is the kind of the litmus test. If I could solve that for you, what's it worth? Well, you know, I don't think we have any budget for that. Or they might come back and they might say, if you could solve that, we'd probably give you a national holiday inside our company.
Right.
And that's a big, huge indicator.
So that's when you start to know that you're fixing the right problem, right? When they start building
right.
the floats and they start getting the parade
yeah.
ready, if you solve that problem, because you would have unlocked some real value for them. Solving the problem multiplies the value that they can bring to the bottom line, and so paying your bill is well worth the effort for them at that point, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The trick is, remember, they're not going to say to you, my problem is XYZ. They're going to describe it totally differently.
So for the companies that don't make it to that 10th year, what are some of the problems? Why are they unable to get that deep into the customer's issues to understand that pain point and reward their business with solving it? What are some of those self-inflicted wounds?
Well, some of them are, as an example, falling in love with your solution, your own solution, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with the thing that got you into business, but the problem is the market changed on you. So if you find yourself so in love with your solution and you keep asking the question, why won't anybody buy this? Then it's one of two things. Either it's not solving the right problem, or you're marketing it in the wrong way. So solving the wrong problem might actually be the way you're marketing it. Remember, the guy that created the zipper died penniless because he wasn't marketing it correctly.
Right.
A lot of people don't know this, but Kleenex, you know, sometimes it can be marketing message. Kleenexes were originally launched as a product that was designed to help women remove their makeup at the end of the day. Within 24 months, that product was relaunched as a disposable handkerchief.
Hmm.
Because within a very short period of time, Kleenex found out that ladies were not just using it for removing makeup, but gentlemen and ladies were using it as a means of blowing their nose. And so, you know, you could have a marketing message mismatch. That might be a problem that you have. The other thing is blind spots. We all, as individuals, we have strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail thing. You have to have a way of figuring out, identifying your own personal blind spots, your own personal preferences, because you might enjoy and solving certain kinds of problems inside your business. Like for me, as an example, I come from the operations side of a business. Typically, a CEO is going to grow up in either sales, operations, or finance. And so I love operations. I know that one of my personal weaknesses is cold calls. I can close a sale at that point, you know, we get that deep into the conversation, I'm very comfortable. But if I had to make a living as a door-to-door salesman knocking on cold doors, I would starve to death. So one of the things that I do is I backfill myself with a good salesperson who can go out and break those initial doors open for the business. If you are a CEO who doesn't know what his own blind spots or her own blind spots and preferences are, then you will tend to look at the world through your strengths, which you should, but you need to know what your weaknesses are to backfill them. If you're not backfilling your weaknesses and you need to pay attention to the person that you choose to have fill that role, then you will ultimately also end up solving the wrong problem because, hey, if you're a finance guy, everything looks like a math problem. If you're a marketing guy, everything looks like a sales problem. You've got to be willing to backfill your weaknesses so that you can focus on your strengths.
That's insightful. I preach that constantly of making sure you stay focused on the areas where you have the greatest impact and outsource those tasks that aren't critical to the long-term success of the business. You're giving us a mini MBA in this interview today. I hope the rest of the audience is taking notes diligently, because we are drilling down deep into solving the right problem. So I want to unpack that a little bit more. You grew a company at 50% for 5 consecutive years. Now, tell us one or two things that you did to solve that right problem and achieve that level of growth.
So this kind of blows people's minds when I tell them this, but for the first 27 months, there was not one single employee in that company that had an individual goal. I'll say that again. Not one of my employees in my first 27 months had an individual performance goal. And I know that flies in the face of everything that everybody hears.
Yes, but I almost fell out of my chair when you said that. Why?
Yeah. I focused madly on the culture of the business. It was very, very important to get everybody aligned with who we needed to be to get things done. And I love to use sports analogies, but you know, in sports, you can often find momentum changes and all kind, you know, the big mo, right? And you can see it in body language of the players, where somebody sinks a three at just the right moment, and suddenly the game seems to shift the other way. You see a cornerback get beaten on a long pass, and as he's walking back to the huddle, you can see his shoulders down. And you see the receiver who caught that 50-yard pass, he's walking back to the huddle with swagger. What I wanted was, I wanted every guy in my company, every girl in my company, to be walking back, and I wanted them to have swagger. And I wanted them to believe that we were a company that grew fast and did the right things in the right way. Well, in sports psychology, they call those monster plays that happen, those are precipitating events. So we needed a precipitating event. Well, I had one kind of fall into my lap, in that very early on, we had a prospective client call, and they wanted us to do a job. And the project manager came in, and he says, I told him that we would look at it, but I don't think we can do it. We can't fit it in. You know, I don't know how we're going to fit it in. And I looked at the project manager. I says, you know, nobody's shown that we can't fit it in to me. Nobody's proved to me that we can't fit it in. So let's do this. In a half an hour, let's meet. We had a space we called the bullpen. Let's meet. There's a big whiteboard in there. I want every project for the next 3 months, every person, every asset, every piece of equipment that we need, and we need to know the schedules, and we're going to map this out. And if at the end of that conversation you've proved to me that we can't fit this in, then I'll agree with you and we won't do it. But right now, this client is willing to pay double for us to do this, so we're going to look at this. And he said, okay. And an hour later, we met. We went through the entire exercise, and at the end of that conversation, we figured out how to fit that job into our business. And that was one of those moments where we started realizing, hey, we can get better. We can get more efficient. We can, you know, it was kind of a grow up moment where you realize, you know, we can do this. And if we hold ourselves to the expectation that we are going to do it, then it will happen. And that job is actually the first job that put us over 50% growth that year. I think we wound up at like 50, 51%, 52%, like really close, but it was certainly over 50. That job also is the job that made us profitable that year. Had we not done that job, we would have lost money.
Wow.
Once we landed that job and that locked in that 50% growth every year, then I went back and I just kept talking about how we were a company that grew at 50% every year. And I talked about it, and I talked about it, and I talked about it, and I always talked about when we're going to win the next job. And by August of the following year, we had matched the prior year's revenue by August 31st. So all of the revenue that we collected from September to December would be growth revenue. So my next question was, how do we keep growing, and how do we pull in enough revenue in those last 4 months so that we hit 50%? By the time you've done that twice, as an executive, you're walking around and you're saying, hey, guys, we grow. That's what we do. We get stuff done for clients, and we grow, and we grow. And you start talking, and people start to believe that, and they love being part of that. Employees want to be part of a company that is doing something and going somewhere. And so when you can walk around and you talk about it, and it's a demonstrated fact, and everybody has participated in it, it becomes something that cannot be ignored. None of us can ignore who we are. And so when you are in a company that is doing that, it gets a lot easier. Now, there is a space there where when you're growing your business and the CEO can touch most of the employees every day during their daily life, it's easy that you don't have to have, you know, these written down goals. There is a place, I don't want to say that you can build a 10,000 person company without having written goals. There is a space in there before you hit 50 where you're going to have everybody with written goals so that they know what they're focusing on. But you become an organization that just believes and breathes this fact that you can grow your business at a certain pace, and that's who you are and that's what you do. And I will tell you that it makes onboarding a new employee very, very easy. I know for sure that there are some folks that are listening to your show, and if you've ever had, here's how you know if your culture is not in the right place. If you're a lead executive and you have somebody starting in the next week, or you've recently started somebody, and you found yourself at home the night before that person was going to show up for their first day of work, and you thought to yourself, geez, you know, I'm a little concerned what's going to happen when he gets here and Fred gets a hold of him in the lunchroom and nobody's listening. If you're concerned that you have an employee that might tell this person a different version of the story, then you know you don't have your culture where you want it to be. But that was how we did that. I just focused madly and on this idea that we were a company that grew, and the expectation was that we would grow, and the expectation was that we would fit these projects in and we would somehow get them done. And people start believing that and breathing that and executing that, and then it's no longer just my job because it's now part of the culture.
So the culture and this performance metric driven backbone, anybody can apply that to a business, be it big or small, and create the culture for success. It sounds like what you're saying. So if you're a startup, this should be the first thing you figure out if you want to turn this startup into a business and not have it turn into a job.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, there's actually an easy way to find that point where you can build momentum in your business. You know, if you're listening to the show right now, you might not have a new client calling looking to pay you double for a job. You might not have a new invention that is going to go into production next week. So the question is, well, Phil, how do I find this, you know, this precipitating event, this 50-yard pass play that my receiver is going to catch and give us that touchdown at the key moment? The point is, you got to tap into everybody's belief, their self-belief that they can do what you're telling them they can do. As entrepreneurs, we're blessed with, you know, Herculean self-belief, right? But not everybody functions in that space. And so the tool that I tell everybody is, hey, go back and look at your financials over the last 12 months and find the best 3 or 4 months. And let's just, as an example, use a $1 million business. So let's say if you're a $1 million business, your average revenue is $83,000 a month, right?
Right.
Well, you might have 3 or 4 months where you did over 105,000. So why can't your business do 105,000 a month every month? I mean, that would be what, about a 25% growth rate. 25% on Wall Street is amazing. You know, investors love companies that could do that.
Right.
So if you say, well, guess what, guys? We did $105,000 four times last year. My goal is, I would like us to start doing that in about 90 days. And I'd like us to do $105,000 every month. But here's the trick. Your employees don't come to work to sell $105,000 worth of products or services every day. They come to work to ship a certain number of boxes of chocolates to customers. They come to work to sell, you know, to put brides in gowns. They come to work to cut a certain number of heads of hair for guys that are going to be married or people that are going to special events. They come to work to give a client something. And so you have to talk about it. So you take your 105,000 and you talk about it in terms of, how many clients are we taking care of? And you want everybody to feel like, hey, look, if that bride got her gown from a shop that's not our shop, then she didn't get the best possible experience. And I want every bride that gets married in our town to be outfitted in our wedding gowns. But here's the thing. We're a ways away from every bride, But as an example, three or four times last year, we put 100 brides in gowns in three or four different months. So our goal is 100 brides per month are wearing our gown when they go down the aisle. What do we have to do that? And guys, by the way, we put 100 brides in gowns last year in March, April, July, and September. How do we put 100 brides in gowns every month of every year? If you show them something that they've done, as I said earlier, you can't ignore who you are. And you start to talk about it in terms of what you have accomplished. And I know that those are, you know, so you only did it three or four times. It only takes three or four times to believe that you can do it. But if you walk into your shop and you say, hey guys, next month, we're going to start putting 500 brides in gowns every month. Unless you have something wildly different that you've set up in your business over the last week, everybody's going to laugh at you and they're not going to engage. But if you say to them, 4 months last year, we put 100 brides in gowns. Our average month, we do 80, but 4 months last year, we did it. How do we, you know, what are the things that we did right that allowed that to happen? And how is it that 2 months last year, we stepped on our own feet and we only did 60? I want to stop doing the things that we're doing where we're stepping on our feet, and I want to focus on doing the things that we're doing right. And that was the other piece that we did, was we really just focused on what it was that we needed it to do right. And then we focused very intently on not doing the things where we stepped on our own feet. And so if you talk about winning in a certain way, serving a number of clients, you know, whether it's bridal gowns or boxes of chocolates or t-shirts, hey, you know, I want every little league team in our town to be wearing a uniform that comes from our shop. Great. How do we do that? What does that mean? Well, how do we stop stepping on our own feet? And what are the things that we're doing right? And how do we do more of that? And then you just preach that winning attitude about, hey, you know, we're a company that grows 20% a year. If that's what you can do, great. I can tell you right now, if you grow 20% compounded annually for a number of years, I was talking to a guy that just sold his business for many, many millions. He grew it at a compound annual rate of 20% every year for 20 years. That is a monster of a business today. And a publicly traded company came and bought it from him. 20% is nothing to dismiss. So if that's your number, if that's the number that you get out of your financials over the last year or two, and you talk about that, you talk about doing those things right and not doing the things wrong that you did wrong last year, your business will grow, and it will grow quite quickly.
Well, speaking of selling, what should business owners who are seeking to sell their business do to maximize that value?
Great question. I caution every business owner against or about the practice of what I call ownership accounting. You need to realize that as a business owner, your compensation comes in really about four forms. The first one is time, flexibility of time. Although if you're in a growth mode, you may feel like you don't have a lot of time. But you have the luxury of whether or not you come to work at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock, you know, and those different things. So the first one is time. The second one is your regular paycheck. The third one is your draw. And the fourth one is finally when you sell that business at the end of your run. Ownership accounting is that thing that our tax code lets you do that lets you write off your 200 square foot home office. Why I call that ownership accounting is this. If you are having to run tax deductions through your accounting to make your business look profitable, then you're not running your business proper. And so that's the first litmus test that I look at when I look at a company is, okay, how did this company turn a profit? And I will scrutinize every expense until I see what's really going on. So you want to run your business like this. If you pay yourself what you would pay a hired general manager or a hired CEO to run your business. And on the front side, don't run personal expenses through your business that you would not allow a hired CEO or a hired general manager to run through the business. Now, on the back side, there's operational accounting on the front. On the back side, there's tax accounting, and your tax accountant's going to go ahead and they're going to go ahead and let you have those write-offs. And that's fine on the back side for tax purposes. But if you're using those write-offs on the front side operationally to make sure that your business is showing a profit, then you need to get more focused on what it means to turn a profit.
All of that makes a lot of sense. And I think there are people at home who are just like me, who are glued to every word, because you're painting a picture of running your business today as if it were to grow to a Fortune 500 company tomorrow. Put the best practices in place today, and you're going to maximize the value for the long term.
Yes, and I will tell you right now, I'm not going to tell anybody that it's going to be rainbows and unicorns in the next 24 months if you decide to do this. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be a challenge if you're somebody that's been doing that. But within, I would say, 24 months, you'll fall very much in love with the result that you're getting. But if you have a good accountant, they will help you through this.
You mentioned a good accountant for front and back end accounting to get the business structured to be a viable concern. What other advice would you give an entrepreneur who's either started a business or they're in the middle of a business or they're facing these kind of problems?
Two words: excess capacity. If you go look in almost any year of the Inc. 500 and you read through Inc. Magazine's different surveys, and one of the questions they ask the CEOs is, you know, how did you find that new revenue stream that really helped your business grow? I think the number is pretty close to about 40% of the CEOs will tell you that they were looking for a way to utilize their excess capacity. You know, they had either equipment that was available to be run, or they had employees that maybe had some extra time, and they were looking for a way to use that excess capacity. If you are building a business and you have excess capacity, or if you see a company out there that you think may have excess capacity, I would encourage you to approach them. Think outside the box a little bit. You know, I mean, I think everybody remembers probably roughly about 2 years ago where Subway was trying to come out with a breakfast menu. And they were doing that because traditionally they are a lunchtime and dinner time restaurant, but they had excess capacity during the breakfast part of the day. So look at ways to put your excess capacity to use. If you can do that, for sure, it's going to help your overall profitability. Secondarily, it will likely help you find a new product or service that you can offer. And it forces you definitely to think outside of the box.
Is that part of the magic that got you to 50% was taking advantage of excess capacity?
Absolutely. There is nothing like a whiteboard session to force you to think differently and really take a look at where things are going. And I use the phrase interrogate reality. You know, we all have this perception, right? We fall into this flow and a pace, and we think that things are always done a certain way. But using that whiteboard session to interrogate the reality in your business is where you will find excess capacity. I once worked for a manufacturer, and the owner of that company was not willing to invest in new equipment to build a second assembly line for something until we proved that the first assembly line was running 24 hours a day. So is your business really running at maximum efficiency with its resources? One of the other exercises that you're going to have to do, and this one will be more emotionally painful than it will be, than it will create as far as accounting pain, but that is, as your business evolves, you may have some products or services that you can no longer afford to sell. You know, one of our exercises that we went through, we provided a service that turned out, when we sat down, was losing money hand over fist. I think we were negative 65% when we looked at that service. And the emotional difficulty was that that service was one of the two founding services that that business was created with. And the price, we hadn't changed the price in over a decade, and we were losing so much money on it. And the internal argument was, yeah, but that's who we are. Well, no, actually, it wasn't who we were anymore. It's certainly how the business started, but it was no longer who we were. And so you have to be willing, again, interrogate reality. And we sat down and we looked at this thing, we realized how much money we were losing, and we figured out how we would have to price it in order to continue to offer it. And we more than tripled the price of that service offering. And guess what? The next year, We made just as much revenue as we made the year before, and we reduced the number of clients that we served in that way by over 65%. It was kind of funny the way it worked out here. We tripled the price, the volume went down, but it became a far more profitable service because it was a money loser before we started. So sometimes, you know, as your business grows, you're going to have to sit down and take a look at things and figure out, hey, can I still afford to do this way? Sometimes the answer might be no, and you're going to have a little bit of a battle with yourself on that. But if the numbers say it's not working, then it's not working. So don't be afraid to do that either.
Guys, I hope you're out there with pen and paper writing this down. If you're wondering how to define the phrase I say at the end of every podcast, this is how you do it. You put the products on the whiteboard, and even if you're making money, even if it defines the company, Philip's telling you, find that excess capacity by rethinking it and looking at whether or not it's bringing enough value to the bottom line. If it's not, you may not need to be doing it, and by giving it up or changing the pricing, you're going to create that capacity or profitability that helps you continue to push that business forward. Keep that service, keep it at its current pricing, and guess what? You might not make it to year 10. Philip, this has been fascinating. I need to have schedule you for a second and a third follow-up and make this the mini MBA series because I am getting so much out of this interview. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much, Mark. I would love to come back. We'll have to take a look at the calendar and see when we can book that up.
Absolutely. So in the interim, can you tell our audience where they can find you, how they can reach out to you if they can't wait for the second or third podcast follow-ups? How can they reach out to you and learn more about the genius that you've laid out here in this podcast?
So the one easy way to find me is my website. That is AskPhilipWilliams.com, and my mom spelled Philip with one L, so that's where you'll find me there. Another really good place, reach out to me on LinkedIn. My specific address is Philip-Williams. If you go out to my website, you'll actually find a book called Walk the Talk, where I talk about the different things that you can focus on and the disciplines that it takes to build a business that runs very well and grows at a very respectable rate.
Excellent. Now, when they reach out to you, I'm assuming they can engage you and get help with their business?
Absolutely. I get into those conversations all the time with folks, and if need be, we'll get on the phone and talk about things in more detail. Sometimes I do answer little questions one off, and I'm not adverse to doing that either. So. But reach out, connect with me through LinkedIn, and we can get into that conversation. If you connect with me through my website, you'll get an email back that'll give you an address where we can talk and have a conversation that way.
That's perfect. Well, sir, thank you so much for spending this time with us on the podcast. I have taken a lot from today's discussion, but the two most important things, first, we got to learn how to ask and answer the right questions. And know that question is going to evolve over time, and we have to stay true to it in order to continue to disrupt our market. The second is creating capacity. If we want to grow, we got to have capacity, and we have to have a process around prioritizing the work that we perform. And, those two lessons alone are worth the price of admission on this podcast today. And guys, if you have additional questions, you want to bounce ideas, you want to grow at 50% for 5 years, you have the guy right here who did it and then hosted a party for all the people who wanted to buy that company because there were a lot of them. Great, great, great show today. Thank you, Mr. Williams. We absolutely appreciate it. And we look forward to having you back on future podcasts.
Thank you very much, Mark. I've really, really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Wow. Guys, get your cap and gowns ready because after two more episodes with Mr. Philip Williams, you're going to have a mini MBA. I want to thank Mr. Williams for coming on the podcast. And remember, guys, you can find him at LinkedIn at linkedin.com/IN/Philip-Williams. And you can also reach out to him at his website, AskPhilipWilliams.com. And that Philip again is with one L. remember, guys, support this show. Go to patreon.com/gorillapreneur and donate. If you can't donate money, please go to iTunes or Podomatic and subscribe. Like the show. Love the show. Leave your comments. And please share the love with your friends so others can join the tribe. Gorillapreneurs, Scott Sullivan said it best in Episode 7. Be a mace. Sharpen those spikes. And remember, if you're not breaking something, your company might be the next thing that gets broken.
Thank you for listening to the Gorillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy the book Gorillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. Follow Mark Peterson on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Gorillapreneur. Now I want to close with a quote from the great Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win. Keep fighting, Gorillapreneurs!